China and Japan, a critical relationship. The word critical has at least two meanings, but the relationship between these two great civilizations, two economic and military superpowers, is critical to the future of the human race and happiness of a quarter of mankind. The other is that there is much mutual criticism, especially recently, over such matters as the Yakasuni Shrine, comfort women, history textbook revision, and so on. I have many Chinese and Japanese friends and students, and it saddens me to see the recent anger and bitterness, which actually goes back for many years, since the Sino-Japanese War of the late 1930s on. As an anthropologist who has visited each of these places half a dozen times at least, it seems that all I can do is to try to explain one simple thing. Although much of Japanese civilization has come from China, and it is close by, they are deeply different civilizations. They are as unlike as, say, Britain and India. There are cultural and historical overlaps, but beneath the surface there are immense gaps. I've recently almost completed a book called Japan Through the Looking Glass, which tries to explain how this divergence occurred and what it consists of in every aspect of life, from politics to religion to art and society. Here I shall extract two short bits of the book which try to explain two of the most contentious points of difference related to current antagonisms between these two countries, namely war and sex. These are painful and emotion-raising subjects, so I hope you will be calm and rational in dealing with such tragically deep subjects. I would very much value any feedback on these matters. I'm also trying to explain it to myself and my family. A number of my own relatives were caught up in the events of the Second World War and feel as bitter as some Chinese do about what happened. So to start with, war and peace. It would be possible to argue that in many respects Japan is one of the most peaceful, non-violent, large civilizations of which we know. Buddhism and Shinto shed no blood in their rituals and teach respect and love for others, as does Confucianism. Meeting individual Japanese, I feel far less aggression or threat than I do from people in many other civilizations. The Japanese took up gunpowder weapons from the West in the 16th century and then banned them as too aggressive and dangerous in the following century. Between about 1630 and 1860, Japan was the most peaceful, least war-infected civilization the world has ever known. For many centuries, the European states were tearing themselves apart in almost perpetual internal wars. They then conquered half the planet with fire and sword, exterminating the majority of the remaining tribal peoples on the way. Meanwhile, the Japanese did not have a single war, internal or external. It's true, of course, that for more than 200 years, the samurai still strode around with their two swords and the martial codes were still emphasized. Yet there was peace. Gun crimes were practically unknown in Japan even in recent years. And even today, the criminal organizations ban the carrying of guns. Japan has officially renounced nuclear weapons. Its constitution bans the development of an offensive army or navy. although it has developed a formidable self-defense force. The American visitor, Edward Morse, gives a number of vignettes of what Japan felt like in the middle of the 19th century. Quote, "For 66 miles, rumbling along in rather a rattletrap wagon, not a sight or sound was encountered that was not peaceful and refined. The gentleness and courtesy of the country people, the economy, frugality, and simplicity of living," end of quote. Or again, "Here I was with $100 in my pocket, traveling at night through bamboo thickets and some poverty-stricken villages, having a single jinrikisha man, now and then meeting a traveller, sometimes a crowd of travellers, and I was never spoken to. I had no pistol, no cane even, and yet so assured was I of the gentle character of the people that I did not feel the slightest apprehension." End of quote. Yet all of us know that there is a different side to Japan. Geoffrey Gora, the anthropologist, noted, "The striking contrast between the all-persuasive gentleness of Japanese life in Japan, which has charmed nearly every visitor, and the overwhelming brutality and sadism of the Japanese at war, which has horrified almost every observer and journalist and shocked the conscience of the democratic world." End of quote. The Japanese have been brutal in earlier forays. In their war against Korea in the late 16th century, they collected noses from their enemies, pickling them in salt to be inspected by their generals. When they encountered the warships and imperial expansion of Western powers in the 19th century, the lesson that they must be tough was reinforced. Griffiths summarized how it must have looked to the Japanese at the receiving end of Western imperialism. "For a land impoverished and torn, for the miseries of a people compelled by foreigners, for the sake of their cursed dollars to open their country, what sympathy! For their cholera and vile diseases, their defiling immorality, their brutal violence, their rum, what benefits in return?" So the Japanese emulated the West and built the war battleships, tanks, and planes, and became one of the most formidable fighting nations in history. They modeled their army on the Prussian war machine in the 19th century, and from the 1930s learnt new lessons from fascist Germany. As Singer writes, "That Nazi Germany, which adopted Bolshevist terror methods in fighting internal and external enemies, was the teacher of Japanese army leaders, would go far to explain why Japanese soldiers could be accused of having committed inhuman deeds on a scale unknown in former Japanese warfare." End of quote. They also learned a great deal from Britain. While the Japanese army and fighting methods were modelled on Germany, the British Royal Navy was the inspiration upon which the Japanese Navy was built, and British personnel were employed by the Japanese to advise and train the sailors, and a number of the early warships were constructed in British shipyards. So that when the Japanese rulers decided to annex Eastern Asia in the Pacific War, many of us were touched by a violence which can partly be seen as a boomerang from the violence of the West. In my case, several of my close relatives were involved in the battles against the Japanese troops in Burma and Assam in the Second World War. Many will not need reminding of their fearsome reputation. when I walk from the Chinese to the Japanese hall in the Victoria and Albert Museum, one of the things that strikes me most is the contrast in terms of warfare. In the China, there are hardly any weapons, despite the fact that the Chinese invented gunpowder and much of it all. Yet the moment I enter the Japanese exhibition, I am faced with large displays of amazing swords and the fearsome samurai suits of armor. Many people around the world assume that the Japanese are a very warlike race. They think of the samurai movies depicting medieval Japan. Many are aware of the Second World War with its kamikaze actions and brutality. They may know that the Japanese have glorified war at certain points in their history and even managed to withstand the mighty Mongol armies. From time to time, they even defeated the numerically superior Chinese and Russians, and even held back for a long time the mighty American forces. So the Japanese shocked outsiders by their merciless brutality, but also astonished and impressed them by their discipline, bravery, and efficiency. So it would not be difficult to persuade people that Japan is one of the most warlike civilizations in history. Its core seems to be war, and it has lived by its famous sword. Yet there is still something mysterious about the rapid switching from extreme gentleness to extreme violence. The contrast is well caught in a small vignette by the early 19th century Western Dr. Willis. Quote, "In reality, the bulk of Japanese are peace-loving and very indisposed to violence. But in certain cases, a kind of madness for destruction seizes certain individuals. I have seen the following. A quiet man suddenly, with slight provocation, cuts with a sword severely his neighbor, then cuts his own wife into quarters, then cuts half the head off his child, and finally disembowels himself." End of quote. Nor is it entirely a kind of madness, but rather a tradition of total dedication to the task in hand, including what appears to be an extraordinary level of suppression of all human feeling. Quote, "The samurai, before going into a hopeless contest, sometimes killed his wife and children, the better to forget those three things no warrior should remember on the battlefield, namely home, the dear ones, and his own body. After that act of ferocious heroism, the samurai was ready for the Shinemono Gurui, the hour of the death fury, giving and taking no quarter." That's from Lafcadio Hearn. It's thus impossible to make generalizations. The Japanese are more extremely peaceful and more extremely warlike and violent than almost any other large civilization. How are we to regard them partly depends on who we compare them to. If we look from the Chinese mainland, there are some similarities. China also had a Confucian ethic of harmony, peace, love, and for long periods, almost absolute peace within its vast territories. Yet where they differ is in terms of the martial streak. The Chinese were warlike when the three kingdoms fought each other over several centuries, or as they faced the Central Asian nomads. Yet for long periods, they have tried to contain war. Once the vast Han absorption had taken place, They had been notably modest in their imperial ambition. They have raided neighbours and those societies whom they have for long considered to be tributary subordinates, in particular Vietnam, Tibet, and Korea. Yet China is the only world civilization I know of which does not have as one of its major social orders the warrior. There is no equivalent to the Indo-European warrior group, the Kshatriya of India, the Knights of Europe, nor of the samurai of Japan. There are only the unarmed Mandarin literati. Looked at from China, the Japanese seem warlike. Yet looking from the blood-stained and violent history of Western Europe, there are long periods in large areas of Japan which seem extremely non-violent and peaceful. The Japanese I have talked to find it as puzzling as the rest of us. They know that when they are aroused to anger, they are emotional, lashing out, committing atrocities which shame them later. Even without anger, their iron loyalties and feeling of the innate excellence of their civilization can lead them to treat others as inferior. Yet they find it difficult to apologize for their acts. No one feels personally responsible, and apologies are meaningless. The government often encourages this reaction, even up to the present. For instance, the Ministry of Education's textbook inspectors have sought to censor descriptions of Japanese atrocities during World War II, which has recently caused increased tension with China and Korea. And the Prime Minister continues to visit the war shrine where many Class A war criminals are remembered. As the great Japanese political theorist Maruyama Masao pointed out very forcefully, because of the system of distributed responsibility, no one will admit that they took the decisions which led, for instance, to the horrors of the Second World War. Maruyama summed up this in a paragraph. An uncertain sharing of responsibility was preferred so that no one person could be pointed out as bearing the ultimate responsibility for decisions. It's obvious that the mechanism of the emperor system state had inherent within it the danger of developing into a colossal system of irresponsibility. End of quote. Maruyama's brilliant essay on the War Crimes Tribunal at the end of the war gives many examples of Japanese generals and others who said that they knew from the start that it was a hopeless venture and Japan would lose. We are told that an expression that widely circulated in Japan right after World War II was the, quote, collective penitence of all 100 million Japanese, end of quote, who were presumably responsible for the crime and tragedy of the war. Van Wolferen quotes from the newspaper Asahi Shimbun, in which it was stated, quote, fortunately, at the end, Japan could escape from war. And Van Wolferen comments that war in this perspective is like an earthquake or a typhoon, an act of nature that takes people by surprise. Wolferen continues to quote a Japanese intellectual who wrote of the China War, quote, seen from the outside, Japan appeared to be invading China with imperialist intentions. Seen from the inside, however, most political leaders felt that Japan was being dragged into the swamp of war as part of some inevitable process. End of quote. Perhaps one of the most chilling and striking examples of this is the deposition of General Matsui Iwane during the War Crimes Tribunal. The former commander-in-chief of the Japanese Expeditionary Force in Shanghai commented on the China incident as follows, quote, "It has been my belief during all these years that we must regard this struggle as a method of making the Chinese undergo self-reflection. We do not do this because we hate them, but on the contrary, because we love them too much. It is just the same as in a family, when an elder brother has taken all that he can stand from his ill-behaved younger brother and has to chastise him in order to make him behave properly." End of quote. It is a patronizing and semi-racist attitude which might have come well out of the mouth of many imperialists through the ages. With some elements of the Western white man's burden and the schoolmasterly admission before a beating, "This hurts me more than it hurts you." Yet the Japanese also point to the ambivalences of German, Italian, or Spanish 20th century history. Extreme sophistication and pacifism at times, then militarization and concentration camps at others. What the Japanese do know well enough is that humans are not one thing or another, peaceful or aggressive. As each of us remembers from our childhood, a thin veneer of reason and kindness can cover over deep emotions and anger which burst through. The Japanese live in a landscape where the soft beauties of the blossoms and the moon can suddenly erupt into chaos and destruction, the tsunami, the volcano, the earthquake. So it has been in their history. Long periods of quiet, and then a bloody episode which subsides. The quiet contemplation and serenity turns overnight into marauding armies cutting off Korean noses, or the massacres at Nanking, or horrific experiments with germ warfare in Manchuria, or death marches and terrible prisoner war camps. Yet also they suffered the nuclear bombs unleashed on their cities and the firebombing of Tokyo and other cities with a fortitude and absence of desire for revenge, which is surprising. It's a feature of tribal societies that internally they are often peaceful and people behave gently towards each other. Yet in order to survive in a world without a state, they present towards their neighboring tribes a warlike and ferocious front. The Nagas of the India-Burma border are an example of this. Living in a gentle and peaceable way within the village, they are also traditionally ferocious headhunters. So it seems with the Japanese, both internally peaceful, yet outwardly sometimes bristling and aggressive. It's also characteristic of many tribal societies that when they engage in war against foreign tribes, they consider themselves to be real, full human beings, and their enemies are by definition non-humans, not part of their tribe, incomprehensible, and somehow lacking true humanity. The enormous cruelty and destruction associated with the wandering tribes of the central steppes, the Huns and later the Mongols, are well known. If a city or valley refused immediately to surrender, unimaginable destruction and cruelty was wreaked on it. This was total war, kill or be killed. There was no room for mercy or hesitation. So it has seemed for the Japanese at periods when they have ventured out of their islands. They had long watched the vicious and to them hypocritical and cruel behavior of the Western imperialists and concluded that war was merely a matter of might. Might was right. The victor took all. There was massive destruction, no surrender, kill or be killed. So they behaved in the way in which they thought was the way of war. So they cheated, bombing Pearl Harbor on a Sunday and without warning. They starved prisoners of war or bayoneted them in the hospitals. They behaved as if the purpose of war was just to win, with whatever method was appropriate. The Japanese were slow to go to war, but when they did, it was total. As Ozaki writes, particularly with respect to wars against foreign states, they long remained almost totally inexperienced. In pre-modern Japanese history, peace, not war, was the norm. There developed in the Japanese mind a consciousness that a full-fledged war is something extraordinary and abnormal, something that suggests desperation, utmost gravity, and inevitable death. Or, as our friends explained, for the Japanese, war is a last resort. They are slow to go to war, but when they do, it is a total war, with no quarter given. For Westerners, war seems to be a game. For the Japanese, there is no surrender. They could not understand the limited war of the West, end of quote. They starved and tortured their prisoners, partly because they thought that those they had captured, particularly if they had surrendered, had thereby betrayed their warrior honor. They had not taken the path of death and had thereby forfeited their humanity and any right to be treated as a human. The Japanese did not appreciate the fine and shifting distinctions of Western warfare, of the Geneva Conventions, of the idea that you could firebomb Dresden or slaughter innocents in their thousands, but also had to treat prisoners with a certain minimum humanity. They sometimes behaved more like the Christians had long behaved to the Turks or to the South American Incas and Aztecs. They often exterminated with whatever methods were at hand. And the Westerners, who argued that they played by rules, were duly shocked to meet in the 20th century another set of people who behaved as the Christians had done towards people they had enslaved or colonized in the past, or the Huns and Mongols had done before them. The theme of inexperience is often stressed by those we talk to, particularly in comparison to other imperial nations in the West. The British learnt over centuries of fighting an empire how to limit violence and contain it, and how to win and lose an empire with minimum bloodshed. When the Japanese suddenly erupted onto the Chinese mainland, they had no such experience. They tried to force their newfound subjects to become Japanese, as in Korea. to adopt the language and culture as well as the laws and the politics. In this way, they acted more like the Spanish or the Portuguese, and later the French. Yet the behaviour could often take on a particularly harsh edge if there was resistance, because of a strong racial classification. Islanders tend to think of themselves as a separate race. The English have done so, though the presence of Wales and Scotland has tended to dilute some of this insularity alongside the closeness of the continent. The Japanese, long isolated and with a larger population, have tended to create a strong myth of uniqueness and strong ideas of how their unique civilization, as they think of it, is placed to other in relation to other peoples. For many centuries, Japan was overshadowed by China. It might assert that it was the equal of China, but it was clear where superiority in invention, numbers, and wealth lay. By the later 19th century, however, things were changing, as China's weakness and divisions in the face of rapid imperial and industrial expansion from Europe became apparent. Partly reflecting Western racial categories, Fukuzawa Yukichi first divided the world into four kinds. The lowest were the aborigines of Australia, New Guinea, and elsewhere. Then there were the nomadic peoples, such as those of Mongolia and Arabia. The third were the peoples of Asiatic countries, such as China, Turkey, Persia, and Japan. The highest level by then were the Western nations, such as America, France, England, and Germany, whom Japan should aspire to emulate. A few years later, he replaced this with a three-level model: the barbarous, the half-civilized, and the civilized. The Chinese and the Japanese were in the middle. When the Japanese defeated China and then Russia in two wars at the turn of the 19th century, the ordering was changed. Japan was now in the top club, and other civilizations were inferior. It's quite clear from contemporary actions and literature that in the first half of the 20th century, the Japanese felt, as the English did, that their imperial ambitions were based on racial superiority. The yellow man's burden, as Kipling might have put it, the burden that is to bring civilization to the inferior peoples of East Asia. As with almost all racially based empires in history, if the barbarous peoples whose enlightenment and reform they undertook resisted, they were treated with harshness. This background is, of course, enormously exacerbated during war, when there is a need to turn enemies into non-humans if one is to purposely kill them. Unlike the common Christianity, which at least in theory made German or French enemies still human, some Japanese could behave towards their enemies as if they were non-human, as the Germans did to the Jews. The differential treatment of Westerners and Indians or Chinese in the Japanese prisoner of war camps shows the continuing racism in action. I now want to more briefly turn to the other aspect of my talk, which is to do with sexual attitudes and the clash of moralities between China and Japan. traveling through a big Japanese city, looking at the advertisements in the shops, the trains, or on the many television channels, what is striking is the absence of sex. Advertising hardly uses the power of sexual desire to sell things. A moment's comparison of British or American advertisements with their equivalents in Japan shows a vast difference. Those in Japan hardly ever try to arouse sexual desire. When women are shown, they are usually demure and innocent. Certainly, until very recently, most Japanese women dressed simply and with no attempt to accentuate the breasts or the legs. There is thus, in clothing, makeup, advertising, and much of life, an unaccountable innocence. It fits with the innocence recorded by visitors to many tribal societies, where men and women, to the delight or horror of the visitors, did not seem to have learnt the message of man's downfall in the Garden of Eden. Quote, in short, the erotic aspect of nudity is something new in Japan, one of the many gifts to it of the West. That's a quotation from Maraini. Or, as the editor of the Japan Mail in the early part of the 20th century put it, the nude is seen in Japan, but not looked at. End of quote. On the other hand, there is a prosaic and, to many Westerners, equally shocking matter-of-fact attitude towards the exposure of the human body and the extremes of sexuality in the pornographic industry in Japan. There is the floating world, as it's called, of widespread sexual entertaining with the geisha, and historically a very tolerant attitude to prostitution. A visitor in the early 19th century noted that, quote, the Japanese does not regard a free sex life as bad, much less as sin. The word vice is therefore not the right term for it. Neither the religion nor the society prohibits intercourse with women outside of marriage. And this is the cause for all the remarkable acts which arouse our amazement. A few years ago, Alcock noted how parents sold their children into prostitution. And then, after a number of years in the trade, the children returned and married. Quote, the prostitutes are as keen on going to church, that is temples, as anyone else. And the law guarantees this as a special right. The Japanese society does not look with contempt on these public brothels, precisely because they are public. End of quote. When the Europeans arrived, the Japanese were ready for them. Quote, before they opened any port to foreign trade, the Japanese built two places for the foreigners, a custom house and a brothel. End of quote. There is the long tradition of erotic art in the explicit pillow books, which were, of course, of Chinese origin, which has evolved into a film and video industry where films of extreme violent sexuality are widespread. All this seems to suggest something completely different from the innocence of the clothing and the advertising. When I first went into the local corner shop in northern Japan, in the city I was living in, to buy some food, I noticed both the innocence of the advertisements and the clothing and the rows of pornographic magazines and videos available on the bottom shelves in the shop. Young people were leafing through the most explicit sexual manuals. Staying in almost any Japanese hotel a few years ago at least, there was a greater variety of pornographic channels than I have encountered anywhere else in the world. Copies of the equivalent of the News of the World or the Sun contain cartoons which show men and women copulating with each other, which would not be shown in English newspapers. I tried to work this out with my Japanese friends. They explained that sex is neutral. If you want sex, that's natural. It's quite normal to have sex with the opposite sex or with the same sex. There has been extensive pornography since the 8th century. Sexual behavior is an art like any other, like cooking, calligraphy, or the art of sword fighting. It's an art learnt alongside the proper ways to play musical instruments or perform the tea ceremony. It's a very important part of human life. As craftsmen or specialists in this world, the sexual workers in the Middle Ages formed another guild. Though the high original status of the workers gradually declined, and they were walled into certain areas on the edges of most major cities. So there is an ancient technique of showing the body to men, and very detailed sex techniques at a really professional level. I've discussed this very often and frankly with some of my closer Japanese friends, particularly with outspoken feminist-leaning intellectuals. They explain that women in Japan consider their bodies to be their own, to do with as they like. So being a sex worker is not considered shameful, and certainly not sinful. There is no moral opprobrium associated with it. In ancient Japan, there was an honorable tradition of, quote, oiran, or high-class prostitutes, who have a longer history than the geisha system, which started in the 17th or 18th century, that's the geisha. These oiran were essentially court prostitutes, and some even may have become the wives of lords, and even the emperor. When the 19th century woman traveller, lady traveller Isabella Bird, visited the great Shinto shrine at Ise, she noted that the brothel house and shrine were side by side. Sex and religion were not seen as antagonistic. The ambivalence in the West, in which the body is both a symbol of divinity, a copy of the divine body, and at the same time full of sin and temptation after the fall of man, is totally absent and incomprehensible to most Japanese, who cannot understand what is meant by the idea of a sinful body. They feel it is ridiculous to think of the body as subject to ideas of ethical good and bad in the religious sense. It is their own. They do not apply morality to what they eat or what they excrete, which are subject to ideas of decency and manners, but not related to heaven and to hell. Sex is more or less moral than eating rice. The segregated area, or Yoshiwara, in Tokyo, continuing through the Meiji period right up to the end of the Second World War. During the American occupation, the Japanese authorities set up a similar system for the troops and persuaded not only prostitutes but ordinary women to work there. Our friends tried to explain something about the highly contentious idea of comfort women. That is, women who supplied sex to the army a system which has caused such bitterness in Korea, China, and elsewhere. The system was clearly based and conceived of as modelled on the sex industry in Japan, which again was based on premises about the body and sex, totally at odds with the countries to which it was exported. At first, the comfort women were paid for their work, but the system broke down in many places as the war in East Asia developed. The military took Japanese comfort women to China, and not only prostitutes, but ordinary women were encouraged to go to provide support for the troops. Japanese women were used in the cities, but in the countryside the system faltered and collapsed, and native women were forced into sexual slavery. As regards compensation after the war, we are told that no Japanese women have asked for compensation. Finally, to conclude as I did then, in terms of the future relationship, I hope and believe that there's little to fear directly from each other, since the military and economic world has changed and there's so much to be gained from cooperation. And secondly, that as an anthropologist, my job is to understand and explain differences. As an individual, a personal individual, I may condemn or be shocked or surprised, but my task is to set down the differences, not to morally judge them. I have to believe that the first way to heal old wounds is to give them air, as Maruyama Masao believed. This I hope I've tried to do here. Thank you.